This is the Creative Sports Podcast. My name is Justin Peterson, and joining me are Garrett Wright.
You know, I'm going to be honest. I did not expect to be fashion shamed today on this podcast.
And Brock Rahm.
Yeah, well, we just got a couple professionals over here. It's okay.
This is episode 13. We've talked about audio being the star of the show, so we're digging in more. We talk about setting yourself up for success, different types of mics and ways to capture audio, all the way down to the editing and mixing in post. Let's go, Brock. Five.
No, don't count, don't count, don't count. Just do it when it... Perfect.
Hey, what's going on? It's Justin. Just wanted to give a shout out to APM for providing the track for us here on the Creative Sports Podcast. We're doing this podcast as an extension of the sports creative community on Slack. So if you're finding us and aren't a member of the community yet, you can sign up for free at sportscreativeslack.com. Mic check, 1, 2, 3. Hello, hello. Hey, hey. 1, 2, 1, 2. Can you hear me in the back? Sorry, I had to give a proper introduction there. So today we're talking about audio. And let's get right into it, Brock. I mean, you're kind of the equipment master here when it comes to audio. We talked a little bit about the different kind of plugs, getting the proper mic set up. Let's just jump right in with helping us understand what the best way to record audio is with the room.
Yeah, I will start off by saying I'm in a terrible room for audio right now. It's you're going to hear a lot of echoes. It's going to be very boxy because I'm in a room with no sound treatment and a bunch of 90 degree angles.
I mean, we're in a global pandemic, so just cut us some slack here on this podcast, all right?
What am I supposed to do? But no, I've said it before on this show, and I think it's 110% true, and that's that audio is absolutely the most important part of video. The other thing I've noticed is when I listen back to these podcasts, I say way too much, which is like the number one thing I used to tell people when I produced is like, think about your ums and your ahs and your pauses and how to eliminate them. And then I went back and listened to myself and I do nothing but and ah and pause. So this is me making a conscious effort and putting my flaws out to the world to let people know that I need to improve. So I'm sorry had to sit there and listen to my ums and ahs.
I like this prompt because I was thinking about this too, listening to myself back. I know I said to you guys, it's hard to listen to myself back.
I hate it.
I'm glad we do a little editing to cut some of that out. But yeah, there's a lot that I've learned from recording and listening back to try and improve. So hopefully we're taking steps to improve here along the way. That's kind of what this is about too.
Yeah, when I edit, I actually add ums to Brock. I like copy and paste some in just to make sure that he sounds as dumb as possible. So that you'll know if I edit it, there's a lot of ums for Brock.
Yeah, I put the ums and ahs back in exactly.
We had a professor that used to sit in front of the room say, "Don't say but he said like 35 times per class. So it's just one of those. It's so natural. I said we should take that prompt because I in one of the episodes we were going along and I said one thing, pretty much with every
crutch
question
words.
or I started every question with yeah or okay, or I don't know, you just start to get into your head a little bit with some of that. So hopefully we cut out some of the superfluous comments here and keep things straightforward.
I've never in a million years wanted to be in front of the camera behind a microphone, but I worked with plenty of student broadcasters and we would talk all the time about crutch words. And it's so obvious, you know, you just have a crutch word that you go back to. So, you know, you have to make a conscious effort to get a thesaurus and move away from those crutch words. But I don't take any of my own advice to heart and I use all the crutch words and all the ums and ahs. But it's a good segue into audio. As I said before, I think that audio is the most important part of video. And my background a little bit was we've said it before on the Daryl Miles podcast that I was originally a music major. And I think that's helped me a lot in video, not just in editing, but I also had a huge interest in audio engineering and recording. And I helped some friends run a studio in college and a little bit after college, a recording studio. And so I got a pretty decent understanding of signal path for audio and the basics of recording audio, sound location, space, signal to noise ratio, different types of mics and what they do and what scenarios they should be used in. And I was very fortunate to have that because that gave me a really good base for audio for video. So I think the first thing when I think of with audio is no matter what mic you have, no matter what equipment you have, you need to have a good space to record audio. Right now I'm in a bad space to record audio right now until I treat this room. Four walls, nothing on them to absorb sound, 90 degree angles. You're going to hear the reflection of my voice and the reverberation. Even with, I have some boxes back behind me and stuff for moving, it's not enough to absorb the sound. But that, you know, kind of leads me to my first question for you, Garrett. I know you're not necessarily in charge of doing audio on a scene, right? You have a sound guy or girl. But you are in charge of locations, right? You help scout and pick locations. When you are scouting a location, how much does audio play into your process of picking where you're filming an interview for something like The Journey?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's a lot like video where, you know, I'll talk to, you know, I'll collaborate with my, you know, professionals and operators on site and say, you know, to me, this space looks good. I think we could do some stuff in here. And then I will, you know, trust the camera op or the audio op to kind of give me yes or no. You know, there's some spaces that I can, you know, I know enough to look at and go, boy, this is going to be a nightmare for audio. And, you know, they tell me it's going to be a nightmare and we go somewhere else that maybe doesn't look as good, because I agree with you, Brock. Audio is such a valuable, valuable part of, you know, an interview. And there are other times where we don't have that luxury, where it's like we're kind of put in one space by a school or whatever, and it's, you know, a room away from the weight room, and you're just like praying that no one is going to be in the weight room during that time. And you also hope that your audio staff, you know, has some tricks up their sleeve. So I think it's a mix of, I definitely consider audio when I'm picking a room, but it's a collaboration where you kind of just got to pick trade-offs at time, I would say, is maybe the best way to put it, where visually the space is really good and I don't want to walk away from that just because it has a little bit of an echo or reverb, you know. And because the one thing that I love about our audio professionals on, you know, The Journey is that all of them we work with like want perfect sound, but because they're so obsessive about it, there are times that they're hearing stuff that I am never going to pay attention to, never going to hear in post. And I just kind of have to like sometimes put the headphones on and say like, yeah, that's okay. It's worth that to be in this space and capture what we're capturing visually. So, you know, it's a process, and it's, you just kind of have to understand what you're working with and, you know, what the trade-offs are going to be in working with each different space that you go into.
Right. I think you hit the nail on the head, which is there's probably not going to be a perfect space unless you're in a studio. Even then, I've been in some pretty poorly built studios, you know, one way or another. But the thing, you know, if I'm walking into a space and I'm looking at it from an audio perspective, there's a couple things, you know, that I personally look for, which is the most glaring and obvious one is there going to be a lot of other noise in this room? Right. I listen, and that's not just people coming in and out. That's not just traffic outside. That's, is there a refrigerator in here? Air vents. Can the HVAC be shut off in here? Who do I have to talk to shut off the HVAC and the blower to make sure that's not happening? You know, then beyond that, I'll look into, okay, well, how does this room sound when I stand in the middle of it and talk? Is there a lot of reverberation like there is in the room I'm in right now? Are the ceilings high? Are the ceilings low? You know, those types of things are secondary to the noise coming out. But if you're in a space that has a ton of reverb, you have to know in post, it's really hard to get that out. There are some plugins that do it, but nothing that sounds supernatural. And like Isotopes RX can kind of do it, but that's an expensive plugin suite. You know, that's not cheap. Very much so like, video. I hate the word fixing in post, because you're never certain if you can fully fix it in post, no matter what, no matter how good you think you are of an audio editor. Same with video. I'd rather get it right in the box in quotes, and make sure that I'm getting a product back to my either myself editing or somebody else editing that they don't have to deal a lot with, that they're going to get file and they clean audio, clean video, you know, from the video side. And then you can then sweeten it as opposed to fixing it. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to location, you know, that's really, you know, I think, Garrett, you hit the nail on the head. You know, there's going to be trade-offs. Is the lighting in here worth it to have to take out this air conditioner noise after the fact?
And what kind of mic are you using, I guess, too, is probably the next question that you'd ask. If it depends on if you're using a lav mic.
Depends on your scene.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, my preference 10 times out of 10 is going to be a boom mic. There I am with my right after it. Just followed it right up one after another.
Killing it.
You're missing sports, that's why.
Doing really well out here, guys. But boom mics, to me, are more robust. They're going to capture more body of the voice. And that's because you have more room to do it. It's a bigger capsule. You have a boom mic. Garrett's holding one right now. He's a shotgun mic, same difference. I know that's your personal one that you had from back in your Husker Vision days.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's going to capture more body, whereas a lav microphone has to fit that capsule and that magnet in there into such a smaller place. The physics of it don't work, right? So I'm always going to go, if I have to pick one or the other, I'm always going to see if I can fly a boom over top. And I'm going to want it to be a short boom. There are different lengths of shotgun mics and boom mics, and I don't think people necessarily realize that. I'm going to pick a short boom because I want to be a shorter medium, because I'm able to get the mic closer to my subject. A long boom I would maybe use on top of a camera, or if I was booming from far away, because the pickup pattern is going to be further out. The other thing that a boom mic gives you is a rejection pattern. Every single microphone has a rejection pattern that is essentially behind the microphone. And that is going to take things like reverberations that come up from the top of it, and it won't pick them up. Because if you move out and around the microphone, you don't pick things up. So I want something that's very directional with a big rejection pattern for a shotgun, because I don't want to pick up anything outside of my Talent's voice. Now, my microphone here, which is not a boom microphone, it's an EVRE20. Is built for radio and guests, and it's built so you can talk off access like this. You can't see me, but I'm on the side of the microphone. You may be able to tell a little bit, but versus being straight on it, you can still pick up my voice. Whereas this was a true, very directional shotgun mic. It wouldn't have picked me up there. It would have, and Garrett could probably demonstrate this. So Garrett, go ahead and talk into the front of your mic.
Yeah, this is from the front. And then as I move off to the side here and even a little back behind it, you're probably starting to hear a little bit of difference as I come back to the front.
Yep, exactly. So it's a boom mic over a lav mic is always going to be my preference if I have to pick one. But if I have if I have the luxury of not one man banding it, if I have the luxury of time, if I have the luxury of having the inputs on my sound recorder, I'm always going to do what people call two system audio, which is a boom as a primary and a lavalier as a backup. Because the other thing that always happens when you're in the field, you never know when audio is going to go bad, especially if you're out there by yourself and you're a one man band and you have to be asking the questions and you have the camera set up and you're doing audio. It's hard to monitor all that.
It's hard to remember to hit record in that time.
Hard to remember to hit record. So you really want to protect yourself with a second microphone. The other thing I always try to do is if your audio recorder can do it, like something like a Zoom, F4, F8, a lot of the Zooms do it. They'll record duplicate tracks and you can lower the gain structure on those tracks. So that way, if somebody yells at you or speaks over it, it's not going to overmodulate and you have a backup at a lower volume. And that segue is perfect into how I think of audio levels when I'm recording. a lot of people feel like they need to ride their audio levels as close to zero as possible on a dB meter. And that's not really protecting yourself unless you have a limiter on or a compressor or something that's going to protect you from overmodulating. You're not giving yourself, you think of a camera in dynamic range, right? That would be like exposing your camera as close to the highlights and the sun peaking as possible without it peaking. But knowing that if a camera flash went off or something, it would blow out your sensor. Or if you walked from inside to outside, you'd blow out your sensor. So I always record, I try to keep my audio around 12 dB because that's gives you some headroom, but it also makes it, you don't want to record it too low because you have on preamps what we call just preamp noise, which is the general noise that's made by the circuitry inside the preamp. And if you have to raise the volume, if your audio level is way down at like negative 30 dB or 30 dB, you know, something like that, then you're going to have to raise that up. And when you raise that up, if your audio is close to that noise floor, it's going to bring the noise up too. So,
and you can think of that like, you know, gain in video where it's exactly the same idea. You're trying to raise, you know, your exposure through gain, you know, all of a sudden you're starting to see, you know, the noise. It's the same with audio.
The other thing you have to remember about audio versus video is audio is still very much so, and always will be, a very, very analog world. No matter what, you are taking something analog, which is a voice, and converting that to digital somewhere down the line, whether it's in your camera or a little field recorder. But there are still analog lines that have to go from your microphone to that field recorder. And those lines are susceptible to interference. So XLRs are industry standard. But with that being said, they're very well shielded, but if you put them next to your power cord and your power cord isn't shielded well, or next to a power supply, then you could get noise into it, right? So you got to be conscious about interference. These are analog signals moving back and forth, which are prone to electromagnetic interference until it gets to that little audio recorder that turns it digital. So not really something you need to worry about in video when that digital to analog conversion is really happening in the sensor right there. But it's not really susceptible to much. But with audio, anything that's analog until it gets turned to digital is going to be susceptible. So you need to think about that with your location and your lighting setup. Where are my power cords going? Are they going right along my XLR? Okay, maybe that's the only place I can put it. But when I listen, am I hearing hum from the electrical? Are the circuits grounded where you're at? That's another big one too. A good thing to put in your kit, and I usually have one near me and I don't have it right now, is a little ground lift power adapter. We've all seen them. They take three prongs and they go out two prongs. If your audio recorder doesn't have a ground lift switch, which some of them do, and you have some noise and you think it's coming from the power in the building, you can flip that on and get rid of the ground and see if that fixes your problem. So it's a weird hybrid of, you've got to have the digital understanding of how the audio is recording, but you also need to have the understanding, the analog understanding of, okay, I'm having an issue and it's happening before the recorder, or it's happening in the circuitry in the recorder, and how can I fix it on the fly when my guest is going to be here in 10 minutes and we got to throw a mic on him and we got to get usable audio out of this.
Yeah. And I think a lot of that, I mean, it kind of circles back to the idea of controlling your environment, controlling what you can control. You know, if you're able to control where your power cords go compared to your audio, control that. Like if you're able to control the refrigerator being mm-hmm. plugged in, or the HVAC being on, or, I mean, we shoot on the journey. We do a lot of parent shoots in, you know, personal homes where, hey, the for half
an, who knows?
Yeah. And for like half an hour, hey, can we turn off your AC? Like, or can we crank it so that, you know, it's not, we know it won't run in this half hour. It's just those kind of things are the things that you really need to think about to get good audio, because the number of times that, you know, we've forgotten it and had the AC kick on and just rolled our eyes because it was in the middle of like this emotional bite.
The best and one all of a sudden, happens.
Oh, that is exactly when the AC always wants to kick on, is when you're in the middle of your best answer.
Exactly.
So it's just, I think it's, you're right, Brock. It has to be a combination of knowledge of the technical side, but also just planning and thinking in the same way that you'd plan the look of your video. You have to think about sound in a really thoughtful way. You have to, it cannot be, oh, we'll figure that out when we get on site. Oh, we'll figure that out, you know, whenever the guy or whenever the person, the interviewee gets here. It has to be thought through in the same way with video, with the same intensity, or else you risk losing an entire shoot to bad audio.
So you guys touched on shotgun microphones and boom mics. Let's compare that with omnidirectional mics and lavaliers a little bit. Obviously, if you put a lavalier on, are you hiding that lavalier with tape under somebody's shirt or in a different location so you don't always see that lav? Or are you fixing it in some other way?
So you used a word at the beginning that I think needs a little explanation, which is omnidirectional. It sounds... The word means kind of exactly what it sounds, omni, everywhere, directional. The gain pickup pattern from around the mic is the same all around. So that's one reason I don't love using only lavalier mics, is they're going to pick up not just your voice up at you, but everything around that person, the noise that is going on around that person. So it's a little bit harder to isolate the human voice there. Again, they sound fine, and there's plenty that sound great. Sync and lavs are used on movie sets everywhere. For two system audio, and they use them in mixes all the time when the boom doesn't work or the boom is out of position. So there are good sounding lavs. They're generally more expensive. A lavalier mic is something hard to cheap out on. But in the context of how are you mounting the lav on your talent, right? How are you wiring up your talent? To me, it's about the context. If I see somebody in a sit down interview and they're wearing a polo shirt like I'm wearing right now, and Justin's wearing, and Garrett's just casual Friday over here, no polo shirt on, but which is another good point. And there's an easy place to clip a microphone on and hide the wire up the shirt. You just see the lav sticking out in an interview setting. I think that's fine. But if you're doing something more narrative, more commercial driven, or if they're wearing a t-shirt like Garrett is right now, and it's hard to clip a lav on in a place that's convenient to have the capsule point towards them, I like using just little, you know, moleskin tape, you know, like Rycote makes, or there's a bunch of them that just tapes underneath the shirt, you know, and hides it away. But what you get with that sometimes, and again, this is why it's important to have somebody dedicated to monitoring audio, is you'll get cloth noise, fabric noise, rustling around. And you need to position it in a way to make sure that if your talent's moving around a lot, or if they're fidgeting in their chair, that shirt or whatever they're wearing isn't rubbing on that microphone and hurting your audio if all you're using is a lavalier microphone.
You look like you're just, you know, brushing your shoulder off there.
You know, I'm going to be honest. I did not expect to be fashion shamed today on this podcast. I'm a little hurt by this.
Yeah, well, we just got a couple professionals over here. It's okay.
I'm in a closet. I could just grab one of my polo shirts off the rack and throw it on. I didn't know this was an issue.
You should upstand us here and put on a button down.
Oh, I've got some suit coats. I could pull the suit coat out.
Suit coat is great for microphones because you don't even have to put them up through the shirt. But that's the other thing, especially in a time of COVID right now. How are you getting a lav up and through somebody's shirt? I always give the lav to my talent and say, hey, I need this to go up and through your shirt. I can help you. Or if you want to do it, I can clip it after you put it up and through. It's always an awkward conversation, but you want to make sure your talent is comfortable and know that, like, hey, this wire has to go up and through your shirt. We need to hide the wire one way or another, and make sure they're comfortable with how you're miking them. Now, you might have a sound professional on your shoot where that's their job and they do it every day. But when working with higher profile guests and stuff, they're usually used to it. They usually understand. They'll just grab it, put it up. A lot of times they'll clip it themselves and it's usually pretty good. But I generally like to be the one to clip it on the shirt, because I do a little, and every sound guy in the world knows this, I do a little loop around the back to make sure the wire is pointing down, you know, and sits flush and doesn't make anything weird happen. It's a little loop, and then you tuck it back behind the back clip on a lavalier mic. This makes really good radio. Everybody can see what I'm doing right now. But if you've ever put a lavalier mic on, you know what I'm talking about. But that's important too, is how are you going to wire up your guest? If you're having wireless lobs and you're having them, you know, keep those wireless lobs on for an extended period of time. How are you changing batteries? Is a transmitter covered? There's RF there, so you don't want the transmitter to be in their pocket if they can help it, but you still want to hide it. And that brings me to my next point of, if you have a wireless microphone and you're thinking, oh, well, this will be easy. I can just put a wireless microphone on them and not have to worry about cables, and we'll just get through this interview and it'll be fine. I never, ever go wireless unless I absolutely have to, especially on a location shoot. And Garrett can probably speak to this with the journey, especially on game days. Unless you're miking a player pad or something, you just don't know what RF environment you're walking into. And unless, again, you're in audio, you're at A1 on a set, you know, running audio, then you probably don't have a RF spectrum analyzer on you to figure out what's open, what can work, what won't work. You know, you don't know how old your batteries are in there, even if you have brand new batteries. You just never know when you're on location what kind of RF environment you're running into. So it's always safer, especially if you're just doing an interview and your talent isn't moving around, just to wire up that XLR and save yourself the headache and nightmare.
Yeah, you're just adding one more thing that can go wrong. And there's never any reason to do that in video and audio if you don't have to. I mean, there are enough things that can go wrong on their own, mm-hmm. either through equipment failure or human failure, mm-hmm. that if you add in RF, you are taking a lot of things out of your control as far as reception, as far as batteries, and, you know, the things that Brock just went through. And there's just no reason to do it if you don't have to. It's just most people that do it, I feel like, are well-intentioned. They feel like it'll be easier. But it's, I don't want to call it lazy, because that's maybe unfair, but it's quicker. And sometimes taking that extra 2 minutes to throw an XLR cable on a microphone as opposed to wireless is worth the lack of headaches that only happen maybe one time out of 50, but that one time out of 50 that it happens, you are going to regret the crap out of not wiring up.
And going back to what Brock said, I think you, when you're miking somebody up, you always do it under the guise of we're doing what we have to do to make you look good. That's the ultimate line mm-hmm. that I feel like always gets people to understand that you're doing this with the best intentions to help them look as good as possible. I want to go back to, Brock, what you mentioned about the preamp with the shotgun mic, because you ran it through a preamp, and mm-hmm. there's also phantom power. So you're using the preamp instead of the phantom power. Can you talk through that a little bit?
Well, I think you're conflating a little bit there, because so phantom power is a 48 volt power that some preamps, not all preamps, can put back down the line to help power a condenser microphone. And all shotgun microphones are condenser microphones that require some sort of power. Some of them allow you to have batteries in them to run. The reason is that there needs to be an internal amplification that happens to drive those XLR cables and to drive the signal back far enough. So not every preamp has phantom power, and not every mic can take phantom power, especially back in the day. In fact, if you still, this would be more if you were in a studio setting, a recording studio setting, you could still be using a ribbon microphone on something, which a ribbon microphone is basically a piece of metal that's suspended by two magnets. It's a really cool piece of engineering. Ribbon microphones are, they're very expensive. But if you put phantom power to a ribbon microphone, it can shred that ribbon in there and destroy the microphone. But shotgun mics generally need phantom power. So you want to make sure before you go on a shoot, especially if you have a new camera, new recorder, that your microphone doesn't require phantom power. Can your preamp output 48 volt phantom power? It's usually a button called phantom or 48V. And if it can't, does your microphone have a battery in it? And does that battery, is it charged? So, you know, a lot of different factors that can go in there on whether or not your mic works or not. But 48 volts is the industry standard. It's been that way forever and ever, for condenser microphones. that need it to work. If you plug in your omnidirectional lavalier, it doesn't need phantom power. It doesn't need anything to make it work. But usually with a modern microphone, if you have phantom power on and you put it down, it's not a big deal. It's not going to hurt it. But if you're sitting there with a vintage microphone and you're not sure, always just try it first without phantom power. You know, it's always better safe than sorry.
I think we've done a decent job of covering kind of on-site sound. You know, Brock, maybe there's more you want to run into, but obviously post is another huge part of sound. And to your point, Brock, you never want to take something and say, oh, we'll just fix it in post. But there are a lot of things that you can do in post, and even outside of fixing, things that you probably should be thinking about in post in the edit. I mean, editing sound is hard. And I think, yes, to your point, Brock, having, you know, a music background probably helps me a little bit, where, you know, I was a drummer all the way through high school. And so, yeah, Justin's loving that right now.
Yeah, I was a drummer too.
And I think that really helps me in the sense that I'm able to feel a beat, feel a rhythm, and cut, especially music, but just even understanding the cadence of people's voices and how to cut there, and using, you know, audio transitions, audio effects to clean things up is such a huge part of post. I mean, is that something that you guys see in the work that you do as well?
Yeah. And I think again, we're going to get into some terms here, and I know everybody, when the Oscars come around, oh, what's the difference between sound mixing and sound design and sound editing? And there's a different Oscar for every single one. Garrett did a really good job of outlining what sound editing is there, right? Literally cutting it just like you would video. Mixing to me is anytime you're moving faders up and down and adding effects, you know, to make sure that it sounds full and your mix sounds good. And then sound design is where you're producing and picking Foley and effects and swooshes and bass drops and all that stuff. So good delineation there. They're all post, you know, they're all post workflows, editing, design, mixing. And you got to do all three, and you got to be a little versed in all three. But I think it's good to identify those three different terms.
Yeah. We do all of our own mixing and editing in house. We don't do a lot of design in-house on our smaller projects, on our features and things like that. But if we're doing long form docs, things like that, we will often send them out of house for, you know, audio sweetening and design. And it's unbelievable how much of a difference that can make. I don't think people realize when they watch, you know, a documentary, you know, whether it be sports or outside of sports, and not even a documentary, a film, you know, anything, how much that additional sweetening, how much that additional design can just immerse you into something where you don't even notice that it's been, you know, faked or added. Yep. And that's the key, because, you know, bad, you know, design, bad editing, bad mixing can just as quickly take you out of it. So it's really important that it adds to the feature. But when it adds to the feature, oh my gosh, there's nothing better than watching a piece that you send to an audio, you know, sweetening group, come back with their design and their additions and just going like, whoa, how much did that just add?
You hit the nail right on the head. If good audio editing and mixing and design sounds like nothing, right?
Yes.
It sounds like you can't tell anything happened. I can't tell you how many nights I've sat in an edit suite just literally one frame at a time on an audio edit and dissolves one frame at a time to try and figure and make something sound natural. Yep. If it doesn't sound natural, trying to hide it and make it sound more natural, especially in sports, crowd noise with radio calls transitioning in and out, that I have a library just saved that is just different crowd noise and reactions that I just put in underneath radio call edits to smooth in and out of, if I don't have NAT sound recordings on my ISO recordings that I'm working with, right? So it's a lot of tricks that you're just going to, it's going to be very specific to a project or the industry you work in, but you want to make sure you have that toolkit that's like, okay, I know this works here in this scenario, and I can throw it in and I can make it, you know, finesse it to work. But it took me a long time to understand that and make that work. And I had a lot of guidance from a lot of people who were very good sound editors and sound designers and good mixers who understood it more than me and were willing to help me, but also understood that that sound is subjective, right? I tend to think that sound design is obviously very subjective. It's the most creative part of sound. Sound mixing is subjective. You know, how much EQ, compression, DS, noise reduction you put on is personal preference, and how that's going to work and how it sits in your mix and how you want your mix to sound. But in the end, I think what we all want to strive for is, does it sound natural? And having those things and that tool set to help it sound natural is so critical, and it doesn't just come overnight. But if you're conscious about it and you sit there and you're not okay, and you know when you edit something, you're like, this just doesn't sound right. This doesn't sound like TV. This doesn't sound like a movie. And then taking the time to figure out why it doesn't and how you can fix it, and understand that it might not just be a plugin you can throw on or a YouTube tutorial you can go find. It's going to take time and work on your end to try different things. That's what's going to make you a better sound editor, better mixer, better designer. And then once you have that trick, you can use it over and over and over again.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I've been doing this and editing for, you know, a decade now or more. And I am still very trial and error at points, to your point, Brock. Like, I will sit on an audio transition, be like, okay, 2 frames. No, this needs to be 4 frames. Okay, I need to slide it a frame. Maybe I need to slide the clip a frame and then make the transition back to 2 frames. It's the most frustrating thing, because you, to your point, you know when it doesn't sound right. And pushing through that until it sounds right is so important and so exhausting at the same time.
The thing I'll say too is, you have to be okay with throwing away what is a good visual edit because the sound doesn't work, right? Or yeah, changing it. Like you said, I've changed so many edits one way or the other visually to work better with audio, because overall it was smoother and it worked out better. So you need to be able to let go when something isn't working either, even though you're really, really attached to it and you really, really like it.
Well, and on the feature side, you know, there are times we'll cut bites together, you know, we'll take the start of one bite and tack it on to another, just, you know, not to change the context or anything, but to make sure that, you know, the idea is told succinctly, or, you know, maybe in a better way. Maybe they stumble over the back half of an answer and they have to pick it up. And so we'll tack those two on. And there are a lot of times where it doesn't sound natural, and I'll just completely abandon a bite and find maybe one that doesn't say exactly what I think needs to go in that spot, but I would rather have an 80% as good bite that sounds 100% like from an audio perspective, as opposed to the other way around, where I get this like great bite, but you can tell there are 10 cuts in the sentence.
Exactly. And, you know, I want to dial back a little bit more, you know, from editing and talk a little bit about mixing, because that's kind of where I started. In the studio world, there is editing in the studio world, especially with, there's a lot of editing, but really, a mixing is a key component. And like I said before, mixing is very subjective. There are a couple things that I don't think are subjective about mixing. And there's something that I think every single track, no matter what you're doing with the human voice, needs. And that is EQ first. I always EQ somebody's voice first. And then I do compression. I like compression. I probably tend to overcompress things a little bit, but that's, I think, a little bit of my background. I like that kind of radio sound. I like that kind of compressed, you know, chunky waveform sound on a human voice. And then, you know, on top of that, you need some noise reduction, no matter what it is. And you probably need some DS to get rid of the harshness of the S's. Now running through what each one of those stages do, EQ, everybody's voice sits at a different register on the frequency scale, and EQs go from 0 hertz to 20,000 hertz on like a normal parametric equalizer. And usually anything underneath 80 hertz for the human voice, you don't need. So you can just chop that off. That can sometimes get rid of like air conditioner noise too, because it's so low that you can't really, you don't need it. You can just get rid of it. then the human voice and the octaves from it are like from, you know, 100 to 500. And then there's some overtones there. So what I do is I have a general template that I've made from years and years of doing that I apply to everybody. And then I tweak from there. And that's usually like a cut around 80 Hertz. It's usually like a boost around 200 and 400. And then I do like a 10K boost, for a little bit more, precise and crisper consonants, and a little more top end. And then I use compression, and compression to me is one of the most important things in audio. It's to me what makes amateur audio sound like professional audio. And what that does is that takes all your loudest parts of your audio track and all the quietest parts of your audio track and smashes them together.
YPRs them.
Yep, exactly. Exactly. So if you look at a waveform that's been compressed, it's going to look blocky, right? As opposed to a bunch of peaks and valleys on it. And what that does is that kind of gives you that uniform sound. So certain things aren't too quiet, certain things aren't too loud. What compression also does from a mixing standpoint is you can think of compression like Photoshop layers, right? What you want to be the most present and the most in front, you're going to use the most compression on, which for me is the human voice. So if you have music underneath your track with no compression, it's easy for that voice to get lost in the music track. But if you compress it, that voice is going to sit on top of the music track. Now that music track is super compressed, right? And you don't want to go extreme. You know, you look at a waveform of a audio file and it's just usually like a block because everybody feels like they need to mix it really loud. But to me, compression is really what separates amateur from professional audio. And then after that, after the EQ and compression, it gets a little subjective. Do you hear really hard S's and sibilance? Does it need a de-esser? Do you need to add reverb because it's going to sound more natural for the context of the shot to have a little more room tone and reverb on it? You know, does that make sense? Do you need to do any other, you know, weird effects? The last thing I'll put on it is probably a limiter at 0.1, which is also the same thing as a compressor, only it only works on the high end, and it kind of makes it so instead of your audio over modulating, it compresses it when it hits a certain decibel value. You can mess on compression with thresholds. Attack, I usually go like with a quick attack and a semi medium release. That basically just how quickly is the compressor going to engage when it hears audio and how long is it going to hold on to it before it says, okay, I'm done compressing this, I'll let it go. And then my ratio is usually 4:1 or 6:1, which is just the how much is it going to compress it, right? Just like you if you shoot with a Red camera or a Blackmagic camera with their compressed raw, it has 12:1, 8:1, 5:1, 4:1. I usually do a human voice from 4:1 or 6:1. If you're going for an effect, though, you can go further. You know, if you feel like it doesn't need it, you can go less. So that's what I mean when I say that audio mixing is extremely subjective. It's what sounds good to your ears. But I do think EQ and compression is pretty, and noise reduction are like the three things that every piece of audio needs. And on top of that, if we go back to the location, what's going to help you later on in post is getting a noise print from the room tone. Yeah. It's also my favorite joke to play on everybody is I'll say like, okay, wait for room tone. Everybody quiet. We need room tone. And then I'll go to my associate producer and be like, dude, you're breathing really loud. Can you stop breathing? Stop breathing. Hold your breath. Ready? We'll hold it on 3, 1, 2, 3, hold your breath. And you try and see how long you can get them to hold their breath for room tone. So that's really good joke evil. You can play. Yeah, it's a mean thing you can do.
But do you that do room that? Tone. Do you do that in line with the interview? Like once someone is done talking, or do you record that separate for when the interviewee is actually in the room?
Separate. I don't waste our interviewees' time with it. I usually do it right before we tear down. That's just me personally. You can do it before. You can do it during the interview if you wanted to.
We do.
I don't need them.
I'll go speak ahead. To that on our show. I know that 90% of the time, like, and I'm glad you mentioned it because you mentioned room tone there in your, as you were, you know, talking about the technical side of mixing, but back to location, it's so important because being able to fit that in, you know, pauses that you have to create or edits that you have to create, having that room tone, room print is so valuable after. And on our end, we try to capture it with our interviewee in the chair just so that it is, you know, literally what you're hearing during the pauses when that person is in the chair. And it's not necessary. I think that for the most part, you know, Brock is right. You can capture it without that person there or someone else sitting in the chair or whatever, because it's going to be so minor differences of airflow and all that stuff, you know, without someone in the chair, that it's probably not going to be noticeable. But on our end, we like to capture it. You know, we just ask them to sit there for an extra 10 seconds at the end of the interview, just so that we get the same airflow, the same, you know, sound reflections and those kind of things off of the human body. But it's going to be so minuscule that it's probably overkill on our end.
And if you need to do noise reduction, it gives you a great print that you can throw into your noise reduction plugin learning algorithm to learn the true noise print, that way you're not sitting there searching for silence in between a question or something, and oh, it's not enough, or we didn't, you know, there's multi use there.
And if you can be, you know, if you do have a room where you can't turn off the AC, sometimes it's important to pick up two noise prints, you know, wait mm-hmm. until the AC kicks on again and record an AC noise print and record a silent noise print. And that way you have both, where if it does happen that the AC kicks on during your interview, you can use your AC noise print to, you know, edit and, you know, do some noise reduction passes. So it's really just, it's an additional thing that adds 15 seconds to every shoot, and it will make your life easier on the back end. So do that, please.
I would also say not to underestimate audio as a transition for video with J and L cuts, right? Because bringing in, as you guys are talking about, keeping people involved and engrossed in the piece, a lot of times giving them a general sense of where they're going audio wise helps set that tone for them as you transition video wise.
Do you want to talk about kind of what a J cut and an L cut is, just, you know, for those that maybe aren't familiar with the terms?
It's bringing in audio before a cut. So the audio would bleed in. If you were going to be cutting from, say, an interview and the next shot is going to be highlights or highlight based, like on the field, you would bring that NAT sound audio, start underneath for a J cut underneath that interview, and you start to ramp it up into the game action shot. And then L is the reverse of that, is that you can carry it on and carry it on. And it's really just thinking non-linearly, right? It's more about making sure that, just because there's a cut video wise doesn't mean your audio has to cut either.
You hit the nail on the head too. Talking head interviews too, which I know we do a lot of in sports sometimes, is, let's say you have two cameras, you have a host and you have an interviewee, and you're cutting back and forth between them. You generally don't want to cut right before the person starts talking, right? You either want to see the person first and then have them start talking, or you want to hear the person first and then see them after. Right. So you don't want to butt right up a cut on a sound. And it's one of the biggest amateur mistakes I see for people early on in their career. It's like, well, this person's about to talk, I got to cut right before their first syllable. Right. Whereas it's much more natural if you watch talk programs like, I think, like Dateline, you know, or 60 Minutes, or where they're sitting there and interviewing somebody. They never butt those cuts right up against the syllables. It's always you see somebody and that for a second and then they start talking, or you hear somebody for a second and then they cut to them.
And the one thing that I will say is that you are starting to see that be less of a rule, especially in this kind of YouTube era where you're starting to see jump cuts in videos, and, you know, videos are a little more, you know, fast paced and less transitions and those kind of things. In that world, it is, stylistically, you are seeing less of the J cut, L cut. I think on the professional side, on the more polished side, you still see it. And, you know, to just kind of further describe J cuts and L cuts, like, you know, you basically don't want your video and audio cuts to line up. They're called J cuts and L cuts. Just if you think visually on your timeline, your video is going to be staggered from where your audio starts. So it will make a J or an L, which is why they're called that. But it's, yeah, to Brock's point, that's one of the things that I saw most when I was working at a university, and you guys have all been there, that people just first getting started on video will cut their audio and video at the same time. And it is unbelievable how much of a difference it can make if you see, you know, the farm equipment or whatever in the field and you hear it under your interview before you then see it in the next shot, you know, or highlights in a game or whatever. It makes all the difference in the world. And the second that people start to pick that up is when I feel like you can kind of pinpoint their transition from, to Brock's point, kind of like this amateur learning to really starting to polish off videos. That to me is like one of the biggest differences between an okay video and a good video is just learning J and L cuts. Simple as that.
I thought you were going to give us a remember back in the day with the tape to tape editing or something along those lines.
Oh my God. If I never talk about tape to tape editing. No, I posted a little while back in the general, board of the Slack group about a beer that a brewery next to me made called Betamax and Relax. And I love it because I worked on beta, but no one, I'm sure that joke went over 90% of the people's heads in here because
I resisted the urge to comment saying you're all helped up with nowhere to go.
Hey.
Because it was an IPA.
Yeah, that's really bad. Thanks for resisting. I wish you had now.
That's what I'm here for. Speaking of resisting, audio and post with, what's your target? Brock talked a little bit about hitting 12 dB when you're recording. When you bring it in digital, that changes a little bit, right? Yeah. What do you target there?
I usually mix and master to -6, and that's hot. It's just what I've always done. If you're doing video for broadcast television, do it to -12. It's really where you should be at. I've gotten yelled at by plenty of master control ops that my shows are mixed too hot. So now what I do is stupid, but I mix to -6 and then I bring my master fader down to -12 and set my limiter there. I'll always put a limiter on the master track. And again, you don't want things to slam that limiter because if they slam it really hard, it's just going to compress it and sound unnatural. But you want to make sure that if you're mixing and mastering to -6 or -12, you're not going above that. That's where the ceiling needs to be. And Garrett, I'm sure if you took an episode of Journey right now, I bet it's -12 all the way through. Nothing goes above that -12. That's that's for TV. For web, I'll leave it at -6. Yeah. And even then sometimes people are like, it's too low, but I hate the loudness wars. I hate people who mix to -0.1 or they just slam a limiter at -0.1, you know, and just let things slam up against it. My general rule of thumb, if it's web, I keep it at -6. If it's TB, I just bring that master fader until it's -12 and call it a day.
Yeah, same here. I mean, there's a reason why it goes green, yellow, red, and you want to avoid red at all costs.
Red's bad.
Well, we'd love to hear your thoughts, feedback, and suggestions, so pop on over into the sports creative community on Slack and connect with us and your other fellow creatives. The quickest way to get us to stop this podcast is to not tell anyone about it. So leave us a 5-star rating and don't forget to subscribe so you're the first person to catch each new episode. Remember, the world needs your voice, so keep creating.